Cervix, the podcast. The podcast where pelvic health physiotherapist Emma Brockwell and Gráinne Donnelly talk to incredible guests who help lift the lid and bust the myths on all things pelvic health.
Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of At Your Cervix, the podcast. This week we're interviewing Katie Chapman and talking to her about all things football and life as a mother athlete. For those of you who don't know, Katie Chapman is a former English footballer who last played for Chelsea Ladies and England's women's national team. At the age of 10, Katie began her professional career at Millwall Lionesses. Developing her skill set within the academy, she made her senior debut for the team in the 1996-97 season. Having showcased her ability in the 1997 FA Women's Premier League Cup, Katie was awarded the FA Young Player of the Year, which allowed her to sign a contract with Fulham, making the move to Arsenal Ladies in 2006, then to Chicago Red Stars and her final senior team Chelsea Ladies in 2014. Aside from her senior career, Katie was the under-18 England captain before being selected to be part of the national squad in the year 2000. After making her an international debut in the UEFA Women's Championship, she scored her first international goal in the 2003 FIFA Women's World Cup qualification. Katie has 94 caps for England and retired from international football in 2016. Katie is also a mother of three boys and is now Women's Ambassador for Chelsea Women's Football Club.
Katie, thank you so much for joining us both today.
Good to be here. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, thank you. My God, to say you're a footballing legend would probably be an understatement. You have such an incredible career, and I suspect it would take us hours to really unpick it all. But what I'd love to hear from you, I guess, are what are your highlights? What are your key highlights from your career so far?
Oh, gosh, there's loads to pick from. From FA Cups to representing my country and, you know, Euros and World Cups, obviously having my three children within all of that, and then being able to, you know, live my career and not just me telling them about it. Moving to different clubs really and having success with a lot of different clubs. My career started pretty quickly. I mean, I didn't start playing football till I was 11, and from there I sort of, from the age of 14, I was in the senior team at Millwall and made England debut at 17. So my career sort of picked up really quickly. But no real inspirations, you know, to be a professional. You know, back when I started playing, it wasn't ever really a thing to be a professional athlete, especially a footballer. I was privileged, I think, to get there in the end.
Yeah, it's so young, isn't it? 14. My stepdaughter is 14. That's insane to think of her as a professional footballer on playing with the senior team. I mean, that's so, so young. I mean, That level of that age, you wouldn't start that early now, would you? You would join the academy and then start a little later, I presume. I suspect that's changed slightly.
Then it was sort of I experienced both in my career, you know, semi-professional, inter-professional, then back to semi-professional and back to professional again. So it's like, no, now you wouldn't experience that. It was different back then. I think now girls, you know, are not making the senior team really till their 20s. So a little bit later. And the game's obviously moved on a lot over the years in terms of, you know, the athleticism, the professionalism, the everything about the game has moved on, even the fan base right now and the interest within the women's game. So it's massively different.
Yeah, it's night and day, isn't it? I really want to touch on some of that as we go on with the conversation. But I guess when you started playing it, football was really stereotyped as the man's sport, really, wasn't it? And now the interest, I mean, my God, it's massive. I guess you'll probably know, we're all noticing that more since Euro 2022 last year. Yeah. But what do you think are the key things that have perhaps moved things forwards in terms of the popularity, the fan base, the everything, really?
Obviously, success of games helps, the Euros helped. But I think before then, it was just interest in the game. You know, people visually seeing the game. There's a lot of people that hadn't watched women's football and hadn't seen it. They'd be like, oh, I don't want to go and watch that. It's not very good, without even seeing a game. And I think now the fact that you can see it on the telly more, you know, you can watch most games and it's visually seen. Now we're attracting people to the stadiums because they realise the quality within the women's game. And it is different to the men's game. You know, we don't put ourselves as being men. We're women. You know, although they want to treat us like men most of the time, you know, in terms of training and the way we play, but our game is completely separate from that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've been to see it quite a few times now, and it is, I mean, one of the things I love about it is I think it's really great for families. There's a really lovely atmosphere, isn't there, when you go and watch a women's football game. It's got a great feel to it. It really has. There's a lovely vibe.
Yeah, and all fans mix. We mix and everyone gets on, you know. And it's not that we see so many men there now and boys as well. You know, like before, yeah. we used to, our target audience are girls and women, and it's not. It's everyone, because I always say that if people love football, they love football, relevant of male, female, kids, whatever. They love football, and it's all the same. It's the same game.
Yeah.
There's a lot more development in the youth football, which is really good to see as well, particularly for girls, because I know my daughters, there's a lot of, in our local club, they're doing a lot for the girl development squad. And to actually watch the skill set and the development skill set of the girls is like, oh my goodness, sometimes I'm like, they put the boys to shame at times, in a really good way. So that's been a really exciting thing to see. And if that's how much they're channeling now, it's like the future of women's football as well. Like, it just, you can just see it's going to just get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, and I think the youth part is where we need more work done. That does still need, we're developing that, but I think there's more work that needs to be done, you know, to produce our own players coming through the system. And we're getting there with that, but it just feels like, you know, in the women's game, everything just takes so long. It's step by step, and you have to grab every little bit as it comes, and it's hard, but we're going in the direction.
Why do you think it takes a long time then? Is it funding or a lack of funding?
I think it is funding. It's not very well established, and it hasn't been up until now. And obviously success breeds, you know, people wanting to invest. TV helps massively for people for it to be seen. And it's just that big, it's the interest. And I think the quality of the game now has gone up a level even since I retired. And I think we're seeing that happen. And having a professional league, you know, we're in a good position now, obviously, as the England team, to do well and to win trophies. And, you know, that was evident at the Euros.
Yeah, absolutely.
See, from a, I suppose, coming from your perspective as a woman going into the sport at a very young age, when we're thinking back to those teens age, what did that look like for you? I know it might be different because you're based in England, the accessibility of it. I know just, and I'm thinking more, in my day, there was no girls going off to develop into football at that stage, but there were guys, and there were some of the guys who I was really friendly with. So you might even be familiar with Kieran McKenna. He was the coach on Man United, and he's went on to manage a team now. He left so young. Like, we were all in the same group of friends, and he went away off to England to train. Mm-hmm. And like, to me, I'm like, wow, he's a child still when he's way off making a big adult decision for his future. Like, what was that like? Was that similar for you? Did you have to make sacrifices and decisions at a young age in your life?
Sacrifices, I think, obviously playing in the England under 18s. I was in college at that point doing sports science, actually, and I think I missed a lot of college. And then I got, you know, dragged into the senior team quite early, so I was missing a lot of college work, and felt myself just, I think, photocopying and copying most people's things to try and get by, because I just, fell so far behind. But yeah, I think I didn't even really think about the going away part. I think for me, it was like, it was exciting, you know, to go and obviously represent England and play in tournaments. And yeah, I didn't really think about how young I was. I guess because I was around adults quite quickly, I sort of matured quite quickly within that.
Would you change it now, knowing what the younger players get exposed to? Do you think their exposure to the game is better measured now than perhaps yours was?
Yeah, probably. I think in terms of accessibility as well, you know, they've got so much more. But I also say to my kids, I'd hate to live in this day and age with social media and phones. And I say that a lot when I go and do a lot of talks. You know, we got away with so much back then, you know, in terms of misbehaving and just playing pranks and, you know, doing those sort of things, where nowadays you'd be terrified that someone was filming it or videoing it or putting it somewhere. You know, it's a real different life now to what it was.
So much pressure, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was just, I was just happy to just go and play football. I used to go home from school, drop my bags, go, Mom, I'm going to play in the cage with the boys. I'd go and play in the cage with the boys. No phone, street lights come on. All right, I've got to go home for dinner. Those were, you know, those were the signs of going home, you have to go home for dinner at that point. You know, there was no phones, there was none of that stuff. It was just, yeah, this is what I'm doing. Mum knew where I was, and that was it. You just got on with what you were doing. I mean, I was one of six kids as well, so our household was mental.
I'm one of five, not quite. I was going to say, so I know, and I'm the middle child of five, which the girl is a bit of an oddity.
My mum had two sets of twins. I'm a twin, and I've got twin brothers, and then I have a brother and sister. Yeah.
That's fab. And I'm sure all close together, were they?
Yeah. It was a crazy house. It was also nice because, you know, there was always someone home.
Yeah.
Never empty, so it was great in that sense. Yeah.
But it's funny because we were talking recently, me and my husband, about the fact that this generation is the our kids' generation is the generation of the most change. So, like, you know, we all is like, I find myself going into my parents at times when I hear myself saying things in my day, we didn't have whatever. But there was all those things that you could say a generation apart. But this generation, they have social media, as you say, they have phones. There's a lot of change, like a lot. So we don't know the repercussions of that yet.
Themselves. That's what I thought.
They don't. And everything's everything's instant now. So our kids don't even understand the concept of a lot of what they want is like stuff on demand on TV or something cast to the TV. And if we're busy, we're like, just watch what's on the TV. And they're like, what? Like, what's already in the schedule? Just watch what's on the schedule.
Yeah.
What? Like, we can't have what we want right now. I'm like, this is not good.
God, it's making us sound really ancient.
But I remember black and white TVs and having to go up to the TV to change a channel. Like, that's what I remember. Like, so if you think, like, our kids would find that so cringe, like, to think that, and I'm just like, right. But I do think there's a big change. And one of the things that I see is kind of what you're saying, the lack of mischief and the lack of, like, natural play or outside play, where it's nearly like, right, we don't have much here, well, how can we make a game out of what we have? Everything is,
they don't know what to do with boredom. That's what I say.
No, they don't
know what to do. Where we could entertain ourselves, we became bored, we'd find something to do. They don't know what to do with that, unless it's a device in their hand.
Yeah,
they don't know what to do with it. They wouldn't sit and draw, or they wouldn't sit and, you know, get a football and go out. And I used to go in the garden and do kick-ups and, you know, set things up that I'd practice, but now, no. Yeah, they have to be forced to do stuff.
That's where our development squads need to come in, and they need to create real fun tasks out there for kids, because they're not getting natural exposure to kind of self-made obstacles nearly like that, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
There's also that lack of safety as well, though, isn't there? You know, you said that you used to go off after school to the cage to play football, and I used to go out after school and get on my bike and go around the block. You know, there was just no concern, literally. I remember that my mum and dad would say, just as long as you're back before dark, and then dinner will be ready. Whereas there's no way I'd say that to my kids now. You know, I'd be really quite anxious about that. Perhaps that makes me an overprotective mum, I'm not sure. But it's just such a different world that they're growing up in, and it's really hard for them to navigate it, because we're not used to navigating that sort of world either, are we? Let's be honest. So it's really complex.
But is that because everything's instant, as you're saying, the news, we know all about what's going on in the world now to hand. We didn't back then. We didn't know any of it. Unless you sat and watched the news, you didn't have a clue what was going on in the world. We know everything to hand now. And I think it has made us a nervous wreck in terms of allowing our kids to. And that's not great. You know, it's not great, because they need to have that freedom, and they need to go and learn.
You know, I make mistakes.
I used to get two buses to training and come back by myself. You know, and now it's like mum's taxi. I'm rallying them from here to there and that to that. And if I can't do it, they've got the aunt with me. I'm like, hang on a minute. You know,
well, I agree with you, because we wouldn't have been hearing as much international news, you know, in years gone by. And now we're hearing not just the bad stuff happening around us, but what's happening further away. And it is a lot of, there's a lot of things that are makes everything feel unsafe. But then how do kids get the life skills that they need? Because they need exposure to situations to learn how to adapt to situations. So it's a really hard balance to get.
Yeah,
I don't know. But that's where I think getting them into sports. I think sports is really, really important.
Yeah.
Kids getting the sports that they enjoy, but that they need access to them, and there needs to be kind of life skills built in within them. So if you were to think about what needs to happen in girls' football, you've talked about there needs to be a lot more development. What sort of things do you think need to be prioritised to develop young girls' football?
Do you know what I think in girls' football that I've spoken to a lot of them about is body image. That's a real issue within girls, and especially at that younger age group. I went and did a workshop before, and it was funny because we're talking about boobs and, you know, all that sort of stuff. The girls are sitting there giggling, you know, it's really uncomfortable. But I think we need to make, you know, that sort of body image stuff and periods and all of those things a thing that we can just talk about. There's something that's not embarrassing, that's part of us and it's normal. And, you know, that being fit and healthy doesn't mean slim and athletic. Do you know what I mean? Yes. It doesn't mean slim and athletic. We all come in different shapes and sizes. And I think that's the big part where we lose a lot of girls within sport. Generally, not just football, but within sport, because of that body image, and they feel uncomfortable and those sort of things. So I think that's a big area to focus on, as well as, you know, having the accessibility and football developments available for them to, you know, go and join in their local area, especially people, you know, that live in the outreach communities that need something that's nearby, you know, that they can't travel an hour to go and get to, or that they haven't got the transport to get there or the money.
Yeah, it's a better funding. I mean, you're ticking our boxes in so many ways, because we talk about the importance of educating girls really at school from a pelvic health point of view, you know, talking about what is urinary incontinence, for example, you know, that it does occur even in young girls, yeah. Particularly within the sporting population. We do see young athletes experiencing urinary leakage, for example. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the key barriers to them continuing their exercise for fear of embarrassment. You know, you've seen these awful images of the gymnasts who are mid somersault and they're peeing, you know, and the Daily Mail catches a picture of them mid pee or something. And having space for kids to talk about these things, realize that they're very common, but they're not normal, yeah. And therefore we should be offering them management techniques, treatment to help them improve these symptoms. But, you know, even as far as the menstrual health as well, normalizing periods. And what I like about the latest England football kit is the fact they've come away from the white shorts, haven't they? So that the players can feel more comfortable playing in non-white shorts. I mean, it's crazy, isn't it, really, when you look at tennis players and what they have to wear, tiny little skirts, when you've got your period. I mean, it must be really something else. And yeah, you know, you're on camera as well. You must be sort of having that fear as well. But the education around these things, it's improving, isn't it? It's definitely getting out to the academies. Yes. Yeah. But it needs to probably go into much more mainstream into the schools, which I think is happening, but it needs to happen quicker and perhaps more effectively. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing that, Gráinne, in Ireland? Are you seeing that education is happening in the schools where you are, as well as sort of over here in England?
Not yet, not here, not at primary school level, or is it secondary school?
But, well, primary school, yeah, no. Really, they're starting to have those conversations where I am.
Mm-hmm. Not where I am, no.
Yeah, still a long way to go, isn't there?
Yeah, but we have a devolved government and lots of we have no government, no people turning up for work at the minute. So we are often on a different playing field than you guys, even though we're supposed to all kind of follow suit from Westminster. It doesn't always happen. But it just goes to show, yeah, I think that's a really important thing. And what I was thinking of, Katie, was you mentioned, or Emma maybe mentioned the bio, you have kids. Was that part of your performance career when you became a mother, or was that after?
No, my career, my first one, I was 20.
Oh, did you? Oh, wow. Tell us about that. Tell us about that experience as an athlete and going through that transition.
Do you know what I think? For me, I was at Fulham at that point, and I was a pro for, I think it was my last year there as a pro, because they sat for 3 years in hope that the women's game would move on, and it never did. So in my last year, yeah, I ended up pregnant. It was great, I think, because the manager there was a Norwegian and his wife actually played for the team and they had a child. So I think it made my case, like, I fitted in. He didn't put any pressure on me. He made me feel comfortable with all of it. They obviously put me for a programme. So I had a physio that was looking after me, as well as a doctor there at Fulham. And it's funny because I've just found the book of, I was going through my stuff and I found the book of everything I did while I was pregnant.
Oh,
I was
sitting
there looking at it today and I was like, oh my God, I was crazy. I was crazy. I was doing football drills like up until quite late on, not in terms of no contacts, but just footballs in and out of cones and shooting and all that sort of stuff quite late on in my pregnancy, as well as swimming and gym. And
That's brilliant.
But because I was so young and probably a little bit naive as well, to be honest with you, and I felt good, you know, my body felt good, and I didn't really know a lot about, you know, pregnancy and what to do and how to look after it. But I did, they did educate me in terms of pelvic floor, to be careful of my temperature, my body temperature. Yeah. And just careful in terms of, you know, not falling over. That's your biggest danger, is, you know, falling over to harm the baby. Other than that, as long as you feel okay, you're okay to go. And that's sort of what I took it from.
That's very cool, because that would have been, what, 20 years? Your son is 20?
20 now. Yeah, 2003. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was quite forward thinking, I would say, with your physio that you work with and doctor, because there would have been some hesitancy over you continuing your training. I know you took the contact out, but there would have been a lot of hesitancy around you doing that. But it obviously sounds like you were just listening to your body, had really good support, and I presume you had no issues around pelvic health or any pain or anything during your pregnancy.
No, I had some really, I mean, in the book it says I had a couple of days where I didn't feel great and I didn't go to work, which was fine. Other than that, no real issues at all. I think other than one time I remember shooting and I had to sit down because I thought the baby was coming out. I mean, I sat down and crossed my legs. I remember that vividly. But other than that, no, nothing. Until obviously gone into labour. I think I was in that labour 20 hours and obviously didn't move. I think I was 4 centimetres the whole time. Baby started to get distressed and then I went in for an emergency C-section.
Right. So
other than that, nothing.
And how was your recovery? Did you have specific individualized rehab or what? Yeah, tell us more. When did you
return? The recovery I remember doing myself, to be honest with you. I remember just doing, you know, pelvic floor stuff based on a lot of what I was doing in terms of, I did some circuit sessions with a lot of, you know, pelvic floor stuff, stability stuff, just all the real basic exercises. I think after 4 weeks, I had the baby in April. We had an FA Cup final in May and I wanted to play. I wanted to play.
Did you?
Four weeks after obviously giving birth.
Emergency surgery to give birth.
I was kicking a football against the wall and going, I'm fine. Like, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. And of course the club would let me, I wasn't allowed to play, you know, it wasn't legal for me to play until you get the 6 week, you know, clear. But yeah, it was crazy. Crazy.
Wow. Wow. So when did you actually return to football after your first baby?
I think I returned to training 6 weeks once they sort of said to me I was okay, everything had healed, I was going in the right direction, sort of gradually built myself up. Didn't really start until the following season because it would have been the end. FA Cup was sort of in May. Didn't really go back till the July, maybe. So the 2 months between, I was sort of just building myself up. And getting myself ready to go back for pre-season.
Amazing. And did you have any problems, any issues with returning to sport? You felt good?
Yeah, great. Felt great returning to sport. And my career sort of picked up pretty quickly, really. I moved to a different club, so I moved to Cholton so I could be closer to home. And it made it easier for me to get to and from training, obviously with my baby. And then, 2 years I spent there, and then I moved on to Arsenal. And
how did you navigate the early days in terms of childcare and sleep deprivation? Obviously you were young, but how did that impact, if at all, on your sport?
I always say the sleep deprivation was the worst of all of it. I said to people, that's the hardest thing I found about it. But other than that, I think because I had family around me to help me, obviously, with the baby, made life so much easier. Sleep deprivation, I think I just got on with it. I think I'm so young, just got on with it. I was used to going out before then. Doing good nights out. And I think I was just used to having the amount of sleep I needed and going. So I sort of dealt with it quite well. And I think, you know, the older you get, the harder that becomes. And I certainly noticed that as I got older. When I had my third child at, you know, 31.
How far is between them?
There's 5 years between all of them. So I had my first one in 2003, second one in 2008, and then 2013.
Okay.
And did you have similar pregnancies with the other babies?
No complications whatsoever in the pregnancies. Pregnancies all run really, really smoothly, other than, you know, felt a bit sick sometimes and tired sometimes. Other than that, no, the pregnancies were absolutely fine. I had a natural as well, my second.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they actually pushed me towards a natural.
Back.
Which I was happy about, because I remember crying when they told me they was going to cut me open. I was like, you can't cut me open. You know, like, I didn't want any. I wanted a natural birth, and I wanted, because I knew I'd be back quicker if I had a natural one, but it didn't work out that way in the first one. Second one, yes, natural, other than I did get to have a third degree tear.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a big deal.
Yeah, he was 8'9".
Oh, wow. Oh, right. Was there forceps or anything in that?
No, nothing.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how was your recovery, if you compare the emergency C-section with the third degree tear, how did they compare?
I actually found the natural easier. I really didn't. Do you know what everyone says to me all the time? I think you're a really good healer, and I think I've healed really quickly from whatever it's been, in terms of injury or whatever it is. And I feel like they run quite smoothly. I think I don't remember any issues.
Did you get followed up with physiotherapy or anything after the third degree tear?
Follow up with nobody. Only my midwife.
Wow.
Just my midwife. Yeah. Just my midwife. But having the second one also, they left a junior doctor to stitch me up, and they left the swabs.
Oh, wow.
Inside. 2 weeks post having the child, I was like, I kept smelling this smell. I was like, what the hell is that? And I was so embarrassed. I got to the point, I rang my midwife, who was the same for my first child, and I was like, listen, there's something's not right. This smell will not go away. I'm washing. She burst into tears. I went in there, she was like, oh my God, they've left the swabs in. And it was like that close from
goodness, that's really serious. Yeah.
Yeah. She pulled it out and the smell was disgusting.
Oh,
was
like, wow. Oh my
goodness. Yeah.
Oh, you poor thing.
That was quite like, you know, I could have died in that,
yeah,
you know, in that moment. But yeah, again, I think, you know, being so young and just sort of pick yourself
resilient.
Up.
Resilient. Yeah.
Keep going. Yeah. Just keep going.
Yeah.
So you never even had any like bowel urgency after that third degree tear or anything? Because oftentimes that's what the risk is that it can give us a bit of urgency to have to make a dash to the toilet. Wind control can be impacted. So you've been very lucky. Perhaps your baseline, you know, you're very fit as the baseline, that probably stood to you.
But I remember having my second child, and I remember being in the hospital. I was doing my pelvic floor straight away on the bed.
Good.
The following morning, I'd already started. People were walking in like, what are you doing? I'm doing my pelvic floors. You know, I'm not going to be wetting myself. That's what I used to say to him. And I had so much determination in me. And I'd set my targets where I wanted to go. I wanted to get back playing club football, and I wanted to get back playing international football. And those were my drives and my targets. And I think I just, yeah, pushed myself to get myself back in shape. And, yeah, not sitting. None of that's going to happen.
And what about third delivery? Was it a cesarean section or normal delivery?
No, he was a natural. He was a graze. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. finish on the best one saved your last.
Totally good.
and again, you recovered well, and I mean, you've got that elite athlete mindset, haven't you? Yeah. When it comes to your rehab, you obviously really go for it. You know the goal that you want. Did you return to both international and team football following your third baby?
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah.
So three babies, that's something
else.
Yeah.
That's a massive. And were you the only woman in your team, and even internationally, that had babies at that time? Because there weren't that many footballers, were they, that had babies, I think,
no,
I'm right in
back
saying.
Then, the ones I remember is Mary Phillip, who I played with at Millwall. She had two kids, I think, then, and Marianne Spacey had one girl, but those were the only two that I knew of.
And did they all return back to football after having their babies as well, or did they retire?
They did return, yeah. They did return back. Yeah.
Because do you think there is still this slight anxiety that female athletes, I guess, have in seeing that pregnancy and becoming a mother is a bit of a almost a ticket to retirement, if you like. Do you think there's still that fear that you, once you've had a baby, you can't get back to your sport, or do you think those concerns have been, you know, dispelled now?
I think they've been dispelled, and I don't think it's a fear on our part in terms of having the baby and getting back. I think it's a fear of the industry, you know, like, yeah, in terms of, and I've started to say, like, they, you know, the amount of ACL injuries there's been at the moment in the female game, they're happy to rehab someone for 9 months with an ACL, put for an operation and rehab them back. And they won't necessarily come back in that 9 months, but they're willing to keep pushing. I'm like, well, why don't they just do that for women that are pregnant? We can train during the pregnancy. It's no problem. You just need to know what you need to do with us, you know, and how to manage that. And that's really simple by just education. It's not difficult, you know, to learn that. I learned it myself as a 20-year-old. How to manage it, and I did it for my other two pregnancies. Like, it's not hard.
You're the example. You lived it, like, you did it.
And that's why it's so frustrating for me, and because, you know, they don't tell women the risks of having a baby later on in life. Do you know what I mean? And freezing your eggs necessarily doesn't mean you're gonna have a child at the end of it, you know, like those things. And once you can't have a child, you can't have a child, that's it.
Yeah,
there's that side of it. And I just think, I'm hearing more and more female footballers getting pregnant. But I also hear dreaded stories of some not being managed in the right way and not quite knowing what they're doing and those sort of things. So there's a long way to go with that. But I think, you know, us as females should have the choice, because it doesn't mean the end of your career. It doesn't. It just means as long as you're supported and it's done in the right way and you're taught the right things, it's not an issue.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's interesting. I went to a talk the other week aimed at female footballers and their coaches. Yeah. And there was a talk on pelvic health, but pelvic health for female athletes pre-children. Mm-hmm. There was a talk on egg freezing. There was not a talk on how to return to your sport after you have a baby.
Yeah.
And that was last week. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's still this kind of message being given out that, yeah, pelvic floor really matters, but, you know, do all of that, finish your football career and then have kids. And in the meantime, freeze your eggs. I do think that message is being still given out to some athletes. And it is infuriating, because I think what we're seeing, and you kind of touched on this a minute ago, is that you can have a baby, but also return to your sport, possibly better than before. And we're seeing that with some of the female footballers who have had kids recently. They're going back really impressively, aren't they?
I was the fittest I think I'd ever been.
Yeah, right.
After I had my second child, I was absolutely flying. I was so fit and I felt so fit. And yeah, it's hard. It's hard that you're still hearing that in terms of, you know, they're not being looked after and not being pushed in the right direction in terms of, you know, why can't they have a baby within their career and come back just as good? Because you can. And it is. It's a shame that that's still happening. But I'm sure the more and more it's done and the more it's spoken about and we change, you know, that concept, you know, people will be in a better position to have children during their career.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing now then and how that's working in around female football.
Well, at the moment, I'm the club ambassador at Chelsea. So I do a lot of talks with, you know, all the partners, work with the commercial team, promoting the women's game and stuff like that. My obviously interest at the moment is I've done my PT and I've just put my coursework in, funny enough, for my pre and postnatal. So that's nice. What I want to set up. I'd love to do. And obviously, yeah, the course, the athletic female, I'd love to know both sides of it. So I'd love to know just a regular woman through pregnancy and getting back after that, and then the athletes and what the difference is. I think it'd be interesting for me to learn the difference between the two, because I never see any different. I just did what I had to do. So it'd be interesting to know the facts and sort of behind all of that and what the differences are between the two with a normal person to an athlete.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's really exciting that you're thinking of going down, or you are going down that road, because you bring to the population of women that you'll be working with such a unique insight with your experience. And you also really understand the athletic mind as well. Mm-hmm. And the many voices I'm sure that you hear as an athlete when you're considering getting pregnant. So I think it's really, really exciting. What if anything, have you learned so far that you perhaps weren't aware of when you were pregnant or postnatal?
I don't know the answer to that, really. I think in terms of, I think it is, it's very personal, isn't it? Pregnancy is really personal.
Yeah.
And it's very individual to you in terms of how the pregnancy runs, what complications you have. And you can't predict any of that stuff. You know, if something's going to happen, it's going to happen. And you just have to ride with it. And I think for me personally, I was lucky enough throughout the three pregnancies that I didn't have any real issues within that. But I do believe that exercise obviously helped with that massively. You know, I trained, I think, up to 2 weeks before my due date, and I think it helped massively to return as well, you know, the return part, because I was in a real good place. My body was in a good place to return back to sport. And I think, you know, all the myths need to be, you know, batted away, and, you know, do what's right for you. You know, someone tells you shouldn't be, I mean, I remember the looks that I used to get when I went to the gym and I'd be lifting a weights bar with a lot, big bump in front of me, and people would be giving me the dirty looks as if to say, you shouldn't be here. But I just continued, you know, like that didn't bother me. I was like, you know what, I'm doing it, I'm doing it. Like, I'll continue it. And that's probably my mental toughness, and, you know, sort of, you do what you're doing, I'm doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, you're so tenacious. I love that.
Yeah, and just, I knew what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go. And yeah, it's not your business. And I've got worse at that. I've become more for you like that as I've got older. But I don't care what you think. I don't care if you don't like me.
But the thing is, it's like common sense stuff that you're talking about, because what we know now is that if we limit deconditioning, sure, of course, that's going to, you know, impact your reconditioning needs afterwards. Because if you keep active and maintain muscle mass and maintain, obviously that's going to have you on a better footing moving forward.
Yeah.
And this idea, I don't know how we got into the idea that if we just wrap people up and let them decondition, that this was the best thing for them. Like, but we've done it across multiple domains. We used to do it in cancer rehab too, where when people got a cancer diagnosis and were undergoing treatment, you wrapped them up and didn't let them do anything. You fetched everything for them. Yeah. And that was so debilitating. We've now realized actually the more active they are, the better their outcomes across the board. So I think healthcare is catching up. But a lot of it, when you look at, take a step back and look at it, it's a real common sense, like, of course that's better approach. But I think that it's fantastic that you've done that, and actually three times, not even just had one baby in my back, three times is something that's quite special, and that we need to get that out there, and we need to get people seeing that example, because it's not just inspiring for health and fitness professionals listening to this, but other footballers who are maybe in a place where they maybe don't know when to consider having a family, to show that it can be done. And we can see that across multiple sports, not just football. We've seen track and field Olympic athletes coming back better than ever. Women are made for this. We're pretty resilient, and it's just having, as you say, the understanding and the tools to know how to do it. So what next? What's on the next, what's on the 5-year plan? What changes do you want to make? And we'll hold you to them.
I want to get women back fit and strong. I want them strong through their pregnancy, and I want to get back fit and strong after. And if I can work, you know, within football with athletes in terms of that, and give them my experiences and, you know, push them back to where they want to be, then, you know, happy days. I have a real passion for that. I have a real passion to be involved in that, because I think, you know, it is hard and it is individualized, and, you know, you're going to go through hard times and not, but it's all worth it in the end, honestly. And I always said, my kids, it was great, because football can become so engulfing and so intense in your life. And I found that that little break from football was great for me. It gave me the hunger to want to get back. Mm. And also that I'd go to football and I'd do that part of it. I'd be intense within it then. And I'd come home and I could be mum. I left all of that behind, and I could come home and just be mum. I could be someone different. I can do something different. So I wasn't football all the time. So I think that's what the longevity of my career, because I had my kids and I could, have two separate lives. It felt like mum. I was a footballer, but I was mum when I got home, and it just separated it all. It was great.
Nice work-life balance almost. Yeah. Really, like, it really got that sweet spot. Because I think that's one of the things that no matter what domain that you work in, a lot of us struggle with that in today's world. And we find it hard to, because women do work now and have kids, it's like we're finding it hard to find those barriers. That's really actually nice to hear. Inspiring to hear, and going to get me thinking. I have four kids. And I was going to say, and sometimes it's not the easiest thing to get that the balance right. So
but I also feel like I've had my kids now, like, and I've got my life back again, you know, like they're all older now, you know, I've got 20-year-old, 14-year-old, 9-year-old, and I feel like I'm 40 and I feel like my life's ready to start again. I've also got that, I feel like I've had a whole career and I've had my kids in it, and my kids have come to World Cups and seen it. I'm not sitting there going, oh, this is a picture from here. You know, they've lived in my career, and I'm so proud of that. I really am, because they've
experienced moments.
Yeah, they've experienced moments with me. I'm not just telling them about it. They've been there. Do you know what I mean? They've been on the buses with the girls to come to away games, and they've stayed in hotels, and they've come over to Canada to watch the World Cup. And, you know, those experiences, like, they've been in it. And just I love
incredible.
It. And they don't mind a girl playing football. They train and play with girls, and they'll come out to me and go, "Mommy, oh my God, this girl was amazing.
Oh,
she
reminded
me of the way you used to play." Or, you know, like those. And that's what we're trying to change right now in primary schools.
Quality.
Yeah.
That's funny, because
conversations.
My daughter plays with the boys at football. She plays the soccer, and there's sometimes there's two of them that play, and sometimes there's only just her.
Yeah.
But she loves it, and it's the fact that I think initially it took a while to convince the boys that she was allowed to play, but now she's allowed to play because she's bringing the skills.
Yeah. See, that's what they're all threatened by. That's what it is that we could. That's what it is, really.
Oh, I love this. I think you're so inspiring to women, kids, everyone, and I really hope loads of people listen to this, because it's good. It's a great story and incredibly inspiring. So thank you, Katie, for joining us. Where can people contact you if they're entirely inspired and want to find out more about you or speak to you?
Well, they can either go through my Instagram, or I've got an agent with her email address, depending on what they you know, what information they need and want, on my Instagram page.
Brilliant. We'll put that on the show notes, and we'll link your Instagram to that as well. But thank you so much for all the work you're doing. We are very excited that you will be doing the Athletic Female, and we're looking forward to your feedback from that. Brilliant to have another amazing PT that we as pelvic health physios can link into. I think that's really exciting. Because collaboration is key in supporting any woman, especially in their perinatal journey. So thank you very much for your time, and really excited to see what happens next.
Thank you. Great meeting you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning in. We really hope you enjoyed this episode. We'd love to hear your questions and feedback. And of course, if you love the episode, please leave a review and tell your friends and family all about the podcast. You can contact us on Instagram @@yourcervix_thepodcast or Twitter @@yourcervix_PM. Gráinne and I are really looking forward to catching up with you next week.